This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's no longer just schools preparing for the potential arrival of a deadly active shooter situation. Businesses are also being more proactive as gun violence continues to spread across the country. The Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce is hosting Workplace Safety Forum, True Preparedness for an Active Shooter. And joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about what that means is Fort Thomas Police Lieutenant and Kenton County Regional SWAT team member Chris Carpenter. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, sir.
And we also have Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Professor Charlene Boltz. Welcome, Charlene.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Join our conversation and talk to these experts about how your workplace could improve its preparation for such an event. Call us 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So Chris, there's this program coming up this week at the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce Workforce Safety Forum, the True Preparedness for an Active Shooter. Is this a new development,
businesses? No, sir. This has been going on for quite a few years, and we had that same program through the Chamber of Commerce last year where we were invited to kind of do the same thing. So that's something that's been ongoing here for the past several years.
Are you finding more requests for such presentations in light of the mass shootings that have taken place
Absolutely.
Over recent years?
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of SWAT teams that start out doing this in the beginning have kind of shut that program down because it takes so many resources, so many instructors to kind of do it justice and do a good job of it. In our instance, Kent County Sheriff has been very gracious in offering churches, schools, and businesses 4 hours of free active shooter training if they're in Kenton and Campbell counties, and even sometimes if they're in Boone counties. But he's been very gracious doing that, whereas a lot of teams have shut that down.
Are there any particular industries that are reaching out more often than others?
Corporations are kind of a regular, schools are a regular, and we've seen more churches now, and then some of the ones that you wouldn't think, some nonprofits, daycares, things like that, where you wouldn't necessarily think that'd be one of the usual go-tos for this kind of program.
Well, we're seeing it at schools, of course.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
It's become as normal as a fire drill or a tornado drill on campuses. But workplaces, that seems somewhat unusual, even if necessary. So what are the similarities? What are the differences when preparing a campus versus preparing a place of business, Chris?
The principles in that whole, and again, it's no secret. So the run, hide, fight stuff is nothing that's very complicated. It's designed for people to kind of pick up quickly. It's all on FBI's website, Department of Homeland Security, or DHS's website. And so the principles kind of carry over whether you're at a business or you're at a school or you're at a restaurant with your family or at church. So the good thing is that they span a lot of different environments. but kind of one of the big similarities is that threat doesn't necessarily come from the outside. A lot of people, when they think about active shooter, are always thinking they're going to spot somebody from the parking lot walking in carrying a big backpack with a bunch of guns. And that's just not the case. It's just as likely that somebody's already in the congregation or somebody's already in the business. It's a current employee, that maybe has some kind of grievance, just like it's a current or former student in the case of the schools.
And Charlene, you're a professor of law at
Yes, I am.
NKU Chase. Where did you get the expertise? Because you now consult with corporations and businesses that are looking to implement a strategy. So talk about your background and how you got into this.
Absolutely. So I do currently consult on this particular issue. And my background, it derived from looking at domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, behaviors that could escalate into a violent episode, sometimes homicide, and really evaluating it through a threat assessment lens of how individuals go from a grievance through the steps of progressions of violence to an actual outburst or episode.
So at what point does someone reach out to you? What tends to be their issue?
So I've had two different kinds of clients in this regard. Some corporations have actually asked me to create training programs to educate their employees. Unfortunately, I think that's not broad enough, even though it is on the website of the FBI and Homeland Security and others. I don't find that there is a consistent amount of training with regard to that in all of these entities that is useful for other reasons, which we can discuss. I also find sometimes individuals who are experiencing an interpersonal situation, domestic violence perhaps, and they're trying to assess whether or not the person they're dealing with is progressing toward a much more violent outburst.
You know, this is something that we hear often after one of these all too frequent occurrences in this country. People will then talk about the shooter as they knew this person. Sometimes they're not surprised. Loner or weird, posted a lot of strange stuff on social media. Chris, are there any typical signs that you look for?
Yeah, that's always been one of the great challenges for law enforcement is a lot of these people, a lot of these mass murders, they're not on the police radar before these kind of events happen. We'll hear after the fact that maybe they, in fact, most of the cases where they've communicated their intent to do violence, but people always brush it off because, again, I think there's this tendency in most people to want to think the best because they're not indoctrinated in that kind of that culture of violence. And if you're not, you know, kind of brought up in that culture, you don't realize what people are capable of. And somebody may say, hey, I've got a list or I'm going to go shoot up a school or a business. And you just don't think that's possible because in your mindset, in your cultural experience, you have no frame of reference to look at that.
So how do you teach a group of people on staying alert and see something, say something kind of mentality without going overboard? You know,
absolutely.
If somebody brings fish in and cooks it in the microwave in the kitchen, are you going to lose your mind? Like, this guy lost his mind over this. You know, how do you differentiate between just maybe an outburst versus a consistent tone of behavior?
Right. And what we kind of teach people is to connect the dots. If you can connect a few of the dots, if you're seeing one or two more behaviors, one of the examples I use during our training is I'll show them a couple of pictures that some kids have drawn that look like some pretty violent pictures. And I ask them, do we have a problem in this family? And they'll usually say, oh, yeah, we got a problem. Well, they're actually, the pictures were drawn by my daughters. We're big fans of horror movies and have always been, you know, so... So it's not necessarily an indicator of violence, but if you had something else going on in that family, or you had domestic violence or maybe some drug abuse or maybe some human trafficking or something like that, if you can start connecting a few of the dots, then maybe it's time to take action. An example would be, you know, just because you see a Middle Eastern man approaching your business doesn't necessarily mean it's a threat. Now, if it's the middle of summer and you've got a Middle Eastern man with a heavy winter coat and you see some wires hanging out of the bottom, obviously that's something you want to call attention to.
And that's really what the key is, because, you know, threat assessment is a situational analysis, right? It's multifaceted. People do not the more dangerous person is not the one who necessarily makes the threat. It's the one who poses the threat. And so to evaluate that person who poses a threat, you have to look at a variety of factors. And that's probably the weakness in our responses, is that we're not really forthcoming about talking about those situations, those circumstances, those surrounding issues that seem to indicate that someone is just not blowing off steam to they are really formulating a plan, beginning preparation, moving toward some particular action.
And this is something that we in the media face a challenge with, because a lot of times, I shouldn't editorialize, but it seems like righteousness sometimes. Don't mention the shooter's name. Don't talk about the shooter. Talk about the victims. And you can certainly understand where that's coming from, because you want to mourn those who are lost and not glamorize a shooter so as not to inspire repeat behaviors from others. But don't we want to know all that we can about the people who exercise these types of criminal activities, these types of deadly violence, so that we can learn about what to anticipate?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Because I think that the people you educate about this type of escalation of behavior have to be responsible enough to think it through and to actually apply it, which is why you primarily are looking for your law enforcement, your trained professional who knows how to receive that information, assess it, and evaluate it, and then formulate a plan. And I think that that's where there's a gap in the coverage and the understanding, because you have laws like red flag laws and other things that say, oh, tell us if somebody is dangerous. Well, without any training... What exactly does that mean, right? So there needs to be more of a conversation. And as we move into terminology in the media, such as domestic terrorism and other sorts of things, that involves a much deeper conversation and perhaps an uncomfortable one about what is inspiring people to move from just being upset about something that they've seen or heard to actually progressing along this pathway toward a violent action. That's a difficult conversation and sometimes uncomfortable ones.
And Chris, how do we build profiles of these folks in the law enforcement community? I mean, you mentioned, you know, you should be alert if there's a Middle Eastern man wearing a winter coat in summertime, but there's not been a lot of Middle Eastern men causing these problems.
Absolutely,
in America.
Right.
It's mostly been white guys.
Sure.
And it's also, you know, you mentioned that sometimes it comes from within. We saw that in Virginia, where a former employee shot up the city building. But we also have random acts of violence.
Sure.
With the food festival in California, the Las Vegas concert. What are the common threads?
The common thread for us, and again, maybe this is a simplistic answer just coming from because of the culture that I'm coming from and policing and being kind of indoctrinated in that culture of violence, is people have to understand there are predators out there. As humans, we get so used to being, quote, you know, maybe the apex predator and not having to go through our daily lives worrying about if something's going to eat us or do us harm. But when you look at the rest of the world and the rest, you know, just how every other organism acts, they're always looking out for something else that's kind of going to make them a meal. And in America especially, we're spending most of our time buried in our phones. So it's difficult for them to pick up on other human behaviors and difficult for people, again, who aren't familiar with that pathway to violence to understand why somebody does what they do. From our perspective, there's just evil people out there that do evil things. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're mentally ill. And I think that there's a lot of research that shows that they're not necessarily mentally ill. They're just evil. Now, when it comes to the motivation, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, we kind of live in a unique time now where they have a potential where if you know, 100 years ago, if somebody wanted to commit mass murder and we wanted to know why or they wanted to make a statement, there really was no avenue for them to make that statement. Well, we've provided the avenue with social media and all the avenues now. Somebody can put a GoPro on their helmet, so to speak, like it has been done in New Zealand, some other places, and literally reach thousands upon thousands of people with their message. And if I'm the shooter, I know that a few things, whether I live or die, I know what's going to happen. I know my face is on TV. I know my name is on TV. They're going to talk to my friends. They're going to talk to my family. If there's a manifesto, they're going to read it. My message, whether I live or die, is going to get out there, so I cannot fail. And I think that's something we got to look at to kind of take away that motivation for people.
I wonder what the impact that this deadly trend is having on our culture. You know, I think back to 1999 when we had the Columbine tragedy and what that felt like, how scary that was, how strange it was to think about all those kids dead in one place. And just in the past 5 years, we've had so many worse incidents, from nightclub shootings to other school shootings, festivals, government bases, you know, and we move on so quickly. And then the next one happens. We have our little fights on Twitter about what's the best reaction. And then we move on for a while. And then the next one happens. Charlene, what do you think this is just doing to us as a culture and the way we respond and prepare?
Well, I think trauma leaves a mark on the body and the mind. And I do think the increase of anxiety, perhaps, you know, other sorts of generalized fears that, you know, our children and our workplaces have to now manage that particular risk. People do not have the same level of coping skills for challenges in life. And I think as much as there is a negative, perhaps, impact to these levels of trauma, there is an opportunity for us to have a more honest dialogue about how we're coping with the vicissitudes of life, right? The ups and downs, the bad things that happen. We're sharing coping mechanisms that work. I think this whole mindfulness movement that is out there, meditation, all these sorts of things are beneficial to be honest about the implications of this sort of activity in our society.
And Chris, same question. I mean, just in your line of work of helping people prepare, are you finding this making people, is it making people more interested in being prepared, or is there just a general fear?
Yeah, I think that general fear idea, and that's kind of one of the topics we'll be discussing tomorrow, is that paradox of fear. We get a lot of employers that say, my employees are scared, but I don't want to train them because I don't want to scare my employees. And that makes zero sense, you know, from our environment. But we find that people are already, this is if it's not at the forefront of their mind, it's always in the back of their mind, seeing this happen more and more often. And so they're more open now to that preparedness and more open now to thinking, I don't have to go. We kind of like it. You don't have to go all Jason Bourne. You don't have to memorize all the license plates in the parking lot, you know, keep your back to the exit all the time. But you do just have to go. All it takes is kind of thinking about, when I go into a place with my family, are there multiple exits? Okay, that's it. You know, just having that. If the fire alarm gets pulled, maybe it's not a fire alarm. Having just that little mental plan, but again, not overboard. There's a good balance to be had there, because if you go hypervigilant, like we were discussing before the program, that takes a toll, and a person can't live in that hypervigilant state and be productive for a very long time.
Exactly.
Isn't there also a risk of somebody who's too eager to be prepared, of scaring the employees also and causing panic?
That's a huge problem in training, and that's what one of the things I'm most proud of in our program is that we don't terrorize people. They're already afraid. I think they learn better if they're relaxed, and we throw, you know, some appropriate humor in there, and they learn in that environment. All the pictures we have of our training, people are laughing, having a good time, and they know it's serious. But at the same time, they'll learn a lot better if they don't have that stress of terrorizing people.
We're going to talk about the curriculum that you offer at these things, and we'll get some analysis on that. It includes what a well-prepared business looks like. We'll have that coming up. We continue our discussion on workplaces being prepared for an active shooter situation after this short break. Join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce is hosting Workplace Safety Forum, True Preparedness for an Active Shooter. And joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about what that means is the teacher of that course, Fort Thomas Police Lieutenant and Kenton County Regional SWAT Team member, Chris Carpenter. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, sir.
And Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Professor Charlene Boltz. Welcome, Charlene.
Thank you.
Okay, so Chris, you've got this course coming up at the Chamber, and I want to go through some of the curriculum. I don't expect you to give us the whole lesson for free here. You want folks to come and check out this course, and it looks like you're offering it at a couple of different ways for Chamber members there. We'll have the details at wvxu.org. But it looks like there's basically five chapters here that they sent to me to prepare for this, and the first term is true preparedness, what a well-prepared business looks like. I think you get perspective from both of you on this. We'll start with you, Chris. What do you tend to teach in that portion of the course?
And this is the same thing that's talked about by the Department of Homeland Security, is that mental practice, that mental assent to the facts isn't enough. You need physical practice. So watching a PowerPoint once a year, while most of your employees are on the phone checking Facebook, that's not enough. Watching a video, you know, once a year isn't enough, because if they ever need to use it, the stress that's introduced there, they're not going to remember what they should do. So it really takes that physical practice to kind of prepare those neural pathways and strengthen those pathways so they can do what they need to do.
Well, when you talk about physical practice, are you talking about knocking tables over and hiding behind them, locking doors, barricading yourself?
And we usually do that in baby steps, where, you know, crawl, walk, run approach, where we will talk to them through a PowerPoint, give them that mental assent to the facts. And then we show them what it looks like to barricade. We show them what it looks like to evacuate and avoid bottlenecks and areas to choose appropriate exits. We show them what it looks like to hide. And then we show them exactly step by step how to take down a bad guy. And then we'll usually suit up one of our guerrillas and have them go hands on with one of our guys. We've shown them step by step, and they have a blast doing it. A lot of times we'll come into a place with a blank gun, let them know ahead of time that we're going to be doing that. And even when you let people know ahead of time that, hey, somebody's going to be firing a blank gun, there's still a lot of people jumping and flinching, even with that, because, again, they're just not accustomed to that sort of thing.
Yeah, and guns are loud.
Sure.
And so what kind of impact does this have on people's mindset? I mean, I'm sure that there's a certain sense of comfort in knowing that you've had some type of practice, but that's got to be scary. And does that leave a mark?
Yeah. Our goal is that they remember it, but it's at the back of their mind, where, again, they're not walking through their daily life in fear, and it's not paranoia. Because then you look at the stats, the chances are, we're coming up on, you know, almost 300 of these things in the last, you know, 20 years or whatever. And statistically, out of the millions of targets that are out there, again, the chances are it's never going to happen to you. And if it does happen at your place of business, statistically, you're not going to be one of the victims. But as long as it's at the back of their mind, it's something they just kind of think about. Again, like we were talking during the break about fire drills, and she can elaborate more on that, where it's just becomes a regular part of our daily walk, it's not going to be scary.
Yeah, that was something we did talk about during our break here, Charlene, was that it becomes ubiquitous, like fire drills. You know, we have to do this. Sometimes they're annoying, even though we want to know what to do in case the building catches on fire, but it disrupts our day. We're not really all that scared about it. The fire alarm may be noisy and annoying, but what happens in the case of this particular? This is a different kind of training. And you teach law, so it's like if you're learning how to practice law, it helps to be up on your feet and being in the courtroom. But some trials may hang over lawyers longer than others. Maybe they feel more impacted. So I wonder what you might be able to share about people's feelings after going through this kind of training.
Sure. I think we have to focus, not to get too technical, but it's about how the human brain works, right? How the human brain works when it is confronted with a shocking event like a fire or an active shooter, right? That those, you know, the stress hormones that are emitted in the brain turns off the thinking part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex in the front, and then your older part of your brain, your reptilian brain, is taking over. Well, when you practice and drill, those memories of how you're going to respond get stored in that older part of the brain. And so that's why the benefit of fire training, response to fire works, because we've done it so many times. So we have to sort of extract from that in the active shooter environment, and we need to sort of say, okay, if someone comes through this door, this is how you respond, this is what you do to the tables. You have to practice that to get it in to the back part of your brain, because when you're faced with a real situation, run, hide, fight, right? I mean, people are going to run, they're going to freeze, they're going to do all sorts of things you can't necessarily predict.
But even if we do get a little scared during an actual fire or a tornado and we forget, there are signs, right? There are signs on the walls that say this way to exit in case of fire. In case of fire, pull this. In case of tornado, go here. We don't have those for in case of crazy shooter person in the workplace. Is that something that we could see?
I think we're already seeing it. I mean, yes. You know, a couple years ago, I started the company Livingstone Security Solutions, and that's one of the things that we put out every time we do a training is we give them a card that they can post at their workspace that has the steps, so that not thinking that when this happens, they're going to grab the card and go, you know, number by number
exactly.
On how to escape it. But just seeing that every day and kind of keeping it fresh in the mind, that's what helps them to remember.
Okay, another part of the curriculum that you're offering to the chamber, Chris, is the industry standard, current trends in both attacks and what businesses are already doing to counter them. So let's start with, what are the trends in attacks?
Right, and what we're seeing for corporations especially, well, even schools, is that, again, that idea that the attack is coming from within. These are people that know your business. We do what's called red cell exercises, where as a business owner or business manager, you have to think like the bad guy, knowing what you know about your school's safety protocols, your corporation's safety protocols, your church's safety protocols. Knowing what you know, how would you carry out an attack? How would you do it? And then once you think about that, you can think about how to mitigate that. Then what steps would I take to kind of go through that? Because the people that are perpetrating these attacks, a lot of times are already embedded in that environment, and they already know what the weaknesses are.
And so, what are some of the trends that the businesses are engaging
well,
in?
And most of them now, it's like the schools, you know, where you have controlled access, where you're trying to tell your employees not to prop doors open because they got to go grab a smoke, and this is why we don't do that. You're seeing a lot of the stop the bleed training, which has come out, which is very valuable, not just for active assailant training, but if you have an accident at work or something like that. With you know, most of our first aid kits, you grab a first aid kit off the wall and you got some Band-Aids, a cold compress, some bee sting ointment, and an emergency blanket. Nothing that's going to help you in an active shooter situation or if you were, you know, critically injured. So now we're bringing out training on chest seals, tourniquets, compressed gauze, all those things. It's very easy for people to get a hold of. We teach middle school students how to apply chest seals and tourniquets and compressed and how to stuff gauze. I mean, very valuable stuff that, again, even if they're, you know, maybe not an active assailant environment, but if they're out on the road with their family, they're involved in a car wreck, or they roll up on a car wreck, they're able to help somebody, and it's a lot of good skills that transfer over to different environments.
And again, Charlene, I turn to you for professorial commentary on this because, you know, that's got to impact us as well. The more security you have to go through to get into work, what impact is that having on us?
Distracted workers, distracted staff, distracted students, right? They're more concerned about their safety than they are the substance of what you're trying to accomplish, your productivity, as well as in the school environment, what you're trying to teach. So I do think if we sort of make it more routine, there is a minimization of that sort of distraction, right? Students know it. They know what they're going to do. Then they can put it aside until they need it and concentrate.
Okay, you have item 3 here is predators and prey. That seems rather self-explanatory, but your description here is that the folks who attend this course at the chamber will learn how to create a safety culture by observing creation. I'm not sure what that means. And creation is capitalized here, so I don't know if that's something special.
So the physical creation, looking at the animal kingdom, looking at how animals are designed to survive. Again, we talked a little bit about predators earlier and how predators think. You know, a grizzly bear doesn't worry about somebody attacking it. You know, it's an apex predator. But all the other animals that are down the food chain, of course, they worry about that. And we're really bad about teaching, you know, because not all of us, you know, people have so many differences in their psyches that not all of us are fighters. Not everybody's going to go into that fight mode, even if it meant their life. And we have to understand that. And we have to understand that for our children and at least teach them then, look, if you're not going to go into that fight mode, we need to teach them to be good prey. And what I mean by that is identify the cues earlier. When you see a white-tailed deer, you know, in a field or something like that, if it catches wind of you, it flashes warning coloration, it lets the rest of the group know, and it's gone. You know, even crows post, you know, sentry birds while they're feeding. I mean, all just example after example in creation that we see where those animals that are good, again, maybe they're not predators, but they're practicing their whole lives being good prey. And we need to translate that into some of our kids that we know that aren't going to be, you know, fighters necessarily.
I like that. When I train, I use the term warrior spirit among some of my students. If I have a class of 100, I have 6 warrior students, warrior spirits, who are going to be the first at the door, who's going to direct students out of the room, that sort of thing. And the rest, I'm just training how to protect themselves, self-protect, how to find the exit, how to get your backpack 2.5 to 3 inches of compressed paper is like Kevlar, and, you know, how to really guard themselves to survive.
How do you know who's who in that situation?
You don't. You don't. Not to be too disparaging.
I got you. Go ahead.
The overall statistics when law enforcement are involved in gunfights, about 33% actually hit their target, right? That's the brain on fear, the brain on terror. So if, you know, other than SWAT, and I'm not talking about SWAT because they practice all the time, your average officer is not going to be accurate in their target. So how they're going to respond in that situation can vary, right? The average citizen, the same way.
I guess that's somewhat true, Chris. You've gone through a lot of training. And yes, the SWAT team is a highly specialized group of people who have to be able to hit targets in stressful situations. My dad was captain of the SWAT team in Covington for a long time. So, I know a thing or two about these guys. But regular rank and file officers, you know, they don't really know when they're training down at EKU, you know, and getting ready to join the force until they're in it.
And that's what the public needs to understand. And that's why we have to show people that safety is not the police's responsibility. Safety is your responsibility. Now, we pay people to come help us out in those instances, but you've got boots on the ground. You're at ground zero. You need to do it. Even, you know, Greek historian Heraclitus said that even in battle, out of every 100 men, 10 shouldn't even be there, 80 are just targets, 9 are the real fighters, and 1's the warrior. So you've got cops. Most of them are just regular guys trying to put food on the table, and there's a smaller percentage that shouldn't even be there. We don't know how they got there, who they knew, but they're there, right? But the public needs to understand that, and it needs to be kind of environment-driven. Nobody that looks at Israel and the way their kids go to school thinks that that's strange, and they're under a lot of stress, but they've been doing it for so long, having those threats in Israel, that those kids, again, are kind of indoctrinated into that culture of violence, and it's second nature to them, like you were saying.
So not to throw my own employer here under the bus, but here at Cincinnati Public Radio, we recently had to complete some mandatory sexual harassment training. So that's something that's important in workplace cultures now. We've not, to my knowledge, at least in the 8 months that I've been employed here, we've not had this kind of training. And you have a lesson called The Paradox of Fear, Why Not Training Your People is Counterproductive. So one, before you leave, go tell Rich in the boss's office that we probably should prepare for this. And two, why is it counterproductive?
Yeah, and it's kind of what we said the last time, is that they don't want to train their employees because their employees are afraid. They don't want to train their employees because they don't want to scare their employees. And it's that circular reasoning that just shows why it doesn't work. They're already afraid. If we come in, if we do it right, again, and it takes that balance of not terrorizing people, if we do it in the right manner and we show people that we're there, and most cops like dealing with people that aren't criminals, and it's a treat for us. So if we do it in the right manner and we can interject a little bit of humor, everybody knows it's serious. At the back of their mind, they know it's serious. But just not training people because of fear isn't going to do anything to alleviate that fear, right?
Yeah, I think that we should probably do it here. We all have pleasant speaking voices, and we eat a lot of hummus, and we play classical music. But you'd be surprised, I think, at the level of butt kicking that we could engage in. Okay, and the ultimate weapon. All else is supplemental to this most important countermeasure, and your business already has at least one, .. maybe. Now, this may be a spoiler alert for those who are coming to your class, so I don't know if you want to tell me what this
is. Sure, I think you can figure it out. What do you think it is?
Is it a gun?
It's the mind.
I would have said it's the mind.
Everything else, again, whether you have a gun or whether you can barricade or whatever other tool that you can throw in the mix, it's, you know, the Bible says wisdom is better than weapons of war. And that's an important principle, that if I can ID trouble walking down the street and go to the other side of the street, or if I can stay away from a certain area because I can ID trouble, or if I can look at somebody and tell from body language and from eye contact that they're a potential predator, that is better than any other weapon I could already have on me while I'm waiting to be attacked. So the mind is the ultimate weapon.
I guess I go back to what we talked about a little bit earlier, is that do we run the risk of paranoia in that, or suspicion of our neighbors? And does that make us more difficult to engage with?
We do if we're not explaining, discussing, and preparing. Absolutely. I mean, at this point, it is completely arbitrary as to how in my neighborhood, how anyone's going to respond, because we do not have active dialogue about this issue. We're not talking about our observations. And then so you're left to the unknown as to how a person is going to react in this situation. And that's a very dangerous place to be.
It's called the Workforce Safety Forum, True Preparedness for an Active Shooter. It's being offered by the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce tomorrow, Thursday.
Yes, sir.
Yes,
yes,
August 29th. And is that at the Chamber office?
Yes, sir.
Yes,
on Buttermilk Pike
in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. We've got details at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. So I want to thank our Fort Thomas Police Lieutenant and Kenton County Regional SWAT team member Chris Carpenter. Thanks for coming, Chris.
Thanks for having me,
and
sir.
Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Professor Charlene Bolts. Really appreciate you being here as well.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder, and the technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org.